Clinton's claims America's
President
unilateral...
President Raisi has emphasized that.
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Monday, January 15th, at the stroke of midnight, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launches a barrage of its ballistic missiles. The targets, an Israeli spying nest located in Iraqi Kurdistan, and some terrorist groups based in Syria. These high-precision strikes came a couple of weeks after a twin suicide attack in Kerman killed more than 90 mourners who had come to mark the fourth martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the world anti-terrorism hero. After an unusual suspicious delay, Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack, although many at home and abroad deeply believed it was the Israeli regime who had pulled strings. After the Kerman tragedy, Iran's political and military leadership vowed strong retaliation. But are the recent missile attacks just a tit-for-tat, a revenge for the carnage in Kerman? Are they a message to Tehran's arch foes? Has Iran eventually run out of its strategic patience with them? And should the region brace itself for a new round of tensions? These and more on this episode of Iran Today. By many credible accounts, the Israeli regime is trying to weave a web of spies and terrorists inside and around Iran. You can see the fingerprints of Tel Aviv in sporadic attacks and acts of sabotage against the Islamic Republic. A regime as weak as Israel cannot fight Iran face to face. Hence, it seeks to take revenge for its strategic failures indirectly and through its proxies such as Daesh. To know more, we sat with Dr. Asghar Zoraid, an Iranian expert on the West Asia region. He told us that the operation was precise with no collateral damage.
What do you make of the recent IRGC missile attack on Erbil and Idlib?
You know what happened on the fourth martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani. The Islamic Republic of Iran wanted to show that it's able to beat the enemies on their own turf. So 3 weeks after the Kerman terrorist attack, the IRGC fired missiles from different locations at their bases in Iraq and Syria. The missiles hit the spots, leaving no collateral damage behind. In Erbil, some prominent elements associated with Mossad were targeted. In Idlib, the points where the terrorists used to gather, train, and arm were pounded with missiles.
Needless to say, Tehran is an indispensable part of the resistance axis. A number of groups united together to counter the hegemony of the United States and its cronies, above all Israel, in the region. In fact, the regime considers the Islamic Republic of Iran as the main stumbling block to achieving its expansionist neocolonial goals in the region. On the other hand, a direct military action against Iran is nothing short of a suicide for the already eviscerated regime. The first missile strike targeted gathering places of Daesh commanders and elements in the vicinity of Idlib in Syria. This is Mohammad Shaltouki, a security expert based in Tehran. He said that the missiles targeted the den of anti-Iran terrorists in Idlib.
What were Iran's targets in the attacks, and how significant and important were they?
One of the targets was the gathering place for terrorists in Idlib, Syria. Given some political agreements, Idlib has become a home for several terrorist groups and a key training place for them. So it's not only a threat for Iran, but for the rest of the world. Daesh Khorasan that claimed responsibility for the Kerman terrorist attack has been trained in this area. Many terrorists are being trained here, and sometimes their training facilities are on par with a modern professional army. So the target was a proper choice. Another target was the eastern part of the Euphrates, where the remnants of Daesh are based. As you know, the terrorist group has no realm to rule over, but it's scattered in small groups in the eastern part of the Euphrates, an area between Iraq and Syria. The IRGC targeted some of Daesh commanders, which shows its intelligence superiority over the region.
The second strike targeted the main espionage center of Israel's Mossad spy agency in the Iraqi Kurdistan region, 15 kilometers outside the urban area of Erbil. It was the key headquarters of Mossad in Erbil governorate, made of several layers of concrete, and for this reason, the IRGC used multiple missiles in the strike. Reportedly, nearly 10 Mossad agents and associates were killed in the strikes. Mr. Shaltuki added that unfortunately Erbil has become a center for orchestrating anti-Iran activities.
Erbil was chosen as another target because it was a place for plotting, formulating, and commanding anti-Iran activities. The area has turned into a center for anti-Iran intelligence services. They are present there and have conducted several acts against Iran from this point. For example, the assassination of Mortar Fakhrizadeh was orchestrated from Erbil. Some quadcopter operations against Iran have been carried out from this area. Add to them foiled operations against our country.
The IRGC missile attacks on locations in Syria and Iraqi Kurdistan demonstrate Iran's capacity for carrying out retaliatory operations on simultaneous fronts. The surgical strikes are also indicative of Iran's intelligence superiority over the bases and operations of both Daesh and its paymasters in the region. But which missiles did the IRGC use for these attacks? The IRGC fired four Khaybar Shekan missiles from the southern province of Khuzestan at the Daesh headquarters in the Idlib region of Syria, traversing 1,230 kilometers before striking the target. In addition, nine more missiles of different types pounded locations of other terrorist groups in other occupied territories inside Syria.
What happened in Iraq and Syria had significant messages. For example, Iran used its Khaybar Shekan missiles for the first time. They were fired from Khuzestan and traveled for more than 1,230 kilometers. We could fire those missiles from a closer distance, for example, from Kermanshah or Kurdistan. We chose the farthest point to show the precision and range of the missiles that can strike any target in Tel Aviv, Haifa, and so on. It's a clear message to the Israeli regime.
At the same time, four missiles from Kermanshah province and seven missiles from the West Azerbaijan province in the northwest of the country were fired, aiming the Zionist base in Erbil. Shortly after the IRGC missile operations, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said, "The action was in defense of the country's sovereignty and security. It was an action against terrorism and part of the Islamic Republic's just punishment against violators of the country's security."
What missiles did the IRGC specifically employ in the strikes, and what were their main characteristics?
For these operations, three types of missiles were used. The Fateh 110 missile, which has a range of 300 kilometers, the Fateh 113 missile, which has a range of 500 kilometers, and the Khaybar Shekan missile, which has a range of 1,450 kilometers and a 600 kilogram warhead. It can carry out surgical strikes. It's very strategic and can be prepared very soon in comparison to other types of solid-fuel ballistic missiles. It's among our missiles that can reach Israel, which means those missiles with a range of 1,150 kilometers or above. We used 4 Khaybar Shekan missiles in these retaliatory operations, and they all struck the targets.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more to be said, but first a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to get a word in.
Welcome to the news section of the program, where we'll go over some news headlines. Iran demonstrates missile capabilities with regional strikes. With its strikes on Iraqi and Syrian territory, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is showing that it has become a major regional military power. The BBC writes, "The Erbil attack appeared to underscore the message that not only can the IRGC carry out precision strikes, but also it has the ability to strike military installations near Erbil's international airport, where U.S. and other foreign forces are stationed." IRGC's Erbil missile strike based on legitimate defense. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says a missile strike by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on a building in Erbil in Iraq's Kurdistan region was conducted on the grounds of legitimate defense. Meher News writes, Amir Abdollahian said in a phone conversation with his Dutch counterpart Henke Bruinsschlot on Friday that in striking the targets in Erbil, Iran sought to deal effectively with terrorism in the region. He said the center of plotting some terrorist attacks in Iran, which killed many innocent Iranian people, was an espionage base in Iraq's Kurdistan. The Iranian minister urged the Netherlands to take an appropriate and effective measure to fight terrorism. Iran missile attacks aims to prevent violence and terrorism. A member of the Iranian parliament emphasized on Tuesday that Iran's recent strikes on terrorists and Mossad facilities in Iraq and Syria were conducted with the intention of preventing the escalation of violence of terrorism in the region, asserting that these actions were in line with international law. Tehran Times writes, Abbas Mokhtadai Khurasgani, speaking to Iranian media, highlighted that given the cross-border impact of insecurity and violence, especially evident in recent terrorist activities within Iran, the right to self-defense is inherent according to international legal principles. We possess a legitimate right to quell the roots of violence and terrorism, he stated. Iran promises retaliation for Israel's assassination of IRGC's military advisors. Iranian President Seyed Ebrahim Raisi strongly condemned the assassination of 5 members of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in an Israeli missile strike on the Syrian capital of Damascus, warning that the Zionist regime's move won't remain unpunished. Fars News writes, President Raisi said in a statement on Saturday that the continuation of such terrorist and criminal attacks, which are indicative of the increasing failure and defeats of the Zionist regime in achieving its malicious goals, and the depth of its frustration with the fighters of the resistance front will not go unanswered by Tehran. Well, that's it for today, and I invite you to go back to our main narrative.
The Islamic Republic has always supported peace, security, and stability in the region. Tehran has always respected other countries' national sovereignty and at the same time has considered for itself the legal and legitimate right to deter all security threats. Terrorism is a global threat, and Iran is determined to counter terrorism within the framework of joint regional and international cooperation. Fighting against Daesh was a case in point, where Tehran spared no effort to save Iraq from the curse of this bloodthirsty terrorist group. Statements issued by Iraqi and Kurdish authorities, however, were not that friendly, calling the IRGC action a violation of Iraq's national sovereignty. But was it really? To know the answer, we met with Mr. Abolfazl Amoui, He's the spokesman for the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of Majlis, or the Iranian Parliament.
Some say that the attacks, regardless of the intention, have violated the national sovereignty of Iraq. What do you think?
We targeted the Mossad base in northern Iraq for the sake of our own national interests. It was not a violation of Iraq's national sovereignty. We recognize the country's national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and we have a friendly relationship with Baghdad. If I'm not mistaken, the Iraqi constitution stipulates that Iraq's soil should not be used against a third country. Tehran expects it to be noted. If the security agreements between Tehran and Baghdad had been respected, we wouldn't have had to take such actions. We have sent complete explanations for the Iraqi authorities. At the same time, the door of diplomatic talks is open, and I think the Iraqi authorities are well informed about the activities of this center.
Politicians in the West rushed to use the retaliatory move as a bloody shirt to stir up outrage against Tehran. The UK Secretary of State David Cameron, for example, said the UK condemns Iran's attacks in Erbil. These unprovoked and unjustified actions are an unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Unprovoked and unjustified actions? We asked Mr. Aboulfaz Zohrevand about the violation of Iraq's national sovereignty, something that he categorically rejected. Mr. Zohrevand is a veteran Iranian diplomat with years of experience in politics under his belt.
Some, including Britain's foreign secretary, condemned the attacks as violating Iraq's national sovereignty and claimed it to be unprovoked. What is your opinion?
Violation is not applicable here. Right now, Iran and Iraq are strategic partners. The security of Iraq and the security of Iran are interwoven together. Iran's presence in Iraq is based on cooperation with the central government. Likewise, the Iraqis are present here in Iran. Likewise, both the Iranians and the Iraqis are present in Syria. Perhaps it's difficult for the UK Secretary of State to understand this point. Or otherwise, he is just trying to distort the reality. The term violation is applicable if our action has destabilized Iraq. That's why the Iraqis have been harmed by terrorist groups and some movements and elements associated with the Israeli regime. The presence of elements associated with the Israeli regime without the knowledge and permission of Baghdad is an example of the violation of Iraq's sovereignty. Or likewise, U.S. bases on Iraqi soil is against the country's laws. If they themselves were out of Iraq and then fired missiles out of the blue, that could be called the violation of Iraq's national sovereignty. But you see that it is them that have violated it in the first place.
While critics say such actions from Tehran might escalate regional tensions, the fact is the region is already suffering from mounting and unresolved tensions due to the interference of the U.S. and its allies in the first place. And what the Islamic Republic is doing is mostly a reaction to this undue, reckless interference.
Some say the attacks will add fuel to the fire because the region is already one of the most volatile regions in the world. What is your opinion?
Iran supports peace and stability in the region. What has undermined our regional stability is the presence of foreign forces and the occupation regime of Israel. Take a look at the regime's genocide act against the Palestinian people. At the same time, the regime creates and supports terrorist groups in the region and unleashes them against regional states. We are fully aware that the terrorist groups which act against our country are directed by the Zionist regime and the United States. That's why we think the best way to reach peace and stability in the region is to put an end to the occupation of the Palestinian lands, and at the same time, the presence of foreign forces in the region. For centuries, the people of the region have been living side by side in peace. They know how to solve their problems peacefully because they have a lot in common in terms of culture and religion. I think in the absence of foreign instigation and interference, the region can enjoy peace and stability. So we see the root cause in interference of the United States and the Israeli regime. We believe that the regime will keep fanning the flames of instability in the region for its own benefits. So countering both the US and Israel is to the benefit of Iran and other countries in the region.
The IRGC military action is yet significant from other perspectives. It serves as a reminder that any action against the Islamic Republic will not go unpunished. Some believe it's also a turning point in Iran's approach towards any attack on its soil. This time around, not only the IRGC took responsibility for the attacks, but also tried to publicize it widely. Observers believe the IRGC has sought to hammer home a clear message to its enemies, above all the Israeli regime. Don't mess with Tehran.
To what extent do you think that the attacks were planned and calculated and not just a haphazard strike?
It's Iran's characteristic. Today, most of the international newspapers, such as The Guardian, have acknowledged that Iran is the unrivaled power of the region. I mean, today they are talking about the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the whole region. We don't say that. That's what is said in prominent newspapers and by Western analysts. So imagine that a power like Iran takes action recklessly or rashly. The missile attacks had a clear message. They showed that Iran is still in control over what is being unfolded in the region.
This time around, the retaliatory strikes came fast and furious. It seems that Iran has put aside the in-the-right-place-at-the-right-time strategy, or at least accelerated the retaliatory process to in-the-right-place-at-the-right-time soon.
Do you think that right now we are witnessing the end of Iran's strategic patience policy and we are actually at the brink of a new battle by the resistance axis under the leadership of Iran in the Middle East?
I think that we have to revise this discourse. First of all, a strategic patience doesn't necessarily mean avoiding confrontation, and if you engage with the enemy, it doesn't mean that you have run out of your strategic patience. When you have a clear strategy, every single step you take is accompanied with composure and patience. I mean, you know the blow you have dealt has not been out of anger. When you know what you're doing, it means you still have your own strategic patience.
Moreover, this time around, according to the statement issued by the IRGC, the action was not just in retaliation for the anti-Iran acts of terror, but also for the assassinations of Syrian, Palestinian, Lebanese, and Iraqi figures in the resistance axis. An unprecedented move whereby retaliation is not for Iran, but for the whole resistance front. With the missile operations, Iran has activated two fronts so far, one in Iraq and the other in Syria. The questions are, has Tehran thrown down the gauntlet and is the country going to engage directly with Israel and the United States? And will the next missiles land directly in Tel Aviv? We just have to wait and see.
What do you think the effect of the IRGC attacks on terrorist groups' bases and those affiliated with Mossad has in the long run? Do you think that it would sustain the peace in the region or, on the contrary, it would heighten tensions?
Today, what is important is the power factor. Power has the final say in politics. We have to defend our national interest. If we do not counter the enemy on its own turf, we will have to fight them on our own soil, which is not a great idea. Through resistance, we have managed to undermine the hegemony of the enemy in the region. That's why the Americans are refraining from engaging with us directly. They are constantly sending messages to us saying that they are not going to escalate tensions.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do tune in again same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to send us your comments and topic requests. Till next time, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
path towards enlightenment.
Hello and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In our previous program, we completed explanation of Surah Nuh, and today we start explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Jin, surah number 72 in the serial order of compilation of the Holy Quran. It was revealed in Mecca and has 28 ayahs. The title of the surah indicates that it mainly treats a species of creatures invisible to the human eye and hence called jinn. Endowed with some sort of intelligence and a moral choice to discern good from evil, the jinn have believers and unbelievers amongst them. They were acquainted with the prophets of the past and the previously revealed heavenly scriptures. With the start of the universal mission of Islam, it became incumbent upon them, similar to the human race, to believe in the message entrusted by God Almighty to the mercy unto the whole of creation, that is, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. They will be rewarded or punished according to their specific deeds. The surah ends with ayahs referring to the Almighty Creator's knowledge of the unseen, that is, unknown to all beings. We now invite you to listen to ayahs 1, 2, and 3 of Surah Jin.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. قل أوحي إلي أنه استمع نفر من الجن فقالوا إنا سمعنا قرآنا عجبا يهدي إلى الرشد فآمنا به ولن نشرك بربنا أحدا وأنه تعالى جد ربنا ما اتخذ صاحبة ولا ولدا.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Say, O Prophet, it has been revealed to me that a team of the jinn listened to the Quran, and they said, indeed, we heard a wonderful Quran, that is, recital, which guides to rectitude. Hence, we have believed in it, and we will never ascribe any partner to our Lord. Exalted be the majesty of our Lord. He has taken neither any spouse nor son. God Almighty commands the Prophet of Islam to inform the human society that, unknown to him, his recital of the Holy Quran was heard by a group of jinn, who aptly listened to its words of wisdom and believed in it, saying they had not heard such a highly rational and superior message. This indicates that the jinn possess reason, understanding, perception, and linguistic knowledge, as well as feel the responsibility to spread the message of guidance amongst their community. This group of jinn then proceeded to propagate the message of Islam amongst their community, saying the Holy Quran leads everyone to the straight and unwavering path of God, who alone is worthy of worship, is far too glorious to have any partner in managing the affairs of the universe, and unlike the creatures, is above the carnal traits to have spouses or children. These ayahs teach us that, one, according to the monotheistic perspective, the universe is not limited to the visible creatures of the material world, but as beings and realities of spirit that the physical eyes cannot see. One such species is called the jinn. Two, the intellect analyzes and accepts the words of wisdom and strives towards perfection by shunning falsehood and superstition. And three, true faith is devoid of polytheism and disbelief. Let us now listen to ayahs 4 and 5 of Surah Jin.
وَأَنَّهُ كَانَ يَقُولُ سَفِيهُنَا عَلَى اللَّهِ شَطَطًا وَأَنَّا ظَنَنَّا أَن لَّن تَقُولَ الْإِنسُ وَالْجِنُّ عَلَى اللَّهِ كَذِبًا.
Indeed, the foolish ones among us used to utter atrocious lies concerning Allah. Indeed, we thought that humans and jinn would never utter any falsehood concerning Allah. These ayahs negate the false beliefs, whether of the humans or of the jinn, since both are prone to be misled by Satan, the outcast, who is from among the species of the jinn, and makes people utter atrocious lies concerning the Almighty Creator. An example is the wrongful and misguided belief of the polytheist Arabs, who used to say that the Almighty fathers children through a spouse, and the angels are his daughters. The righteous among the jinn had never imagined that mankind and jinn would dare utter any falsehood against God Almighty. And now, since they have discovered the ultimate truth through proper comprehension of facts, they repent and seek forgiveness in the divine court. From these ayahs we learn that 1. We should not be hasty in accepting superstitions and ideological deviations. And 2. It is a sign of foolishness to entertain false thoughts, utter lies, and resort to mischief. In conclusion of this week's program of Path Towards Enlightenment, we now hear ayahs 6 and 7 of Surah Jin.
وَأَنَّهُ كَانَ رِجَالٌ مِّنَ الْإِنسِ يَعُوذُونَ بِرِجَالٍ مِّنَ الْجِنِّ فَزَادُوهُمْ رَهَقًا وَأَنَّهُمْ ظَنُّوا كَمَا ظَنَنْتُمْ أَن لَّن يَبْعَثَ اللَّهُ أَحَدًا.
Indeed, some persons from the humans would seek the protection of some persons from the jinn, thus only adding to their rebellion. They, the jinn, thought just as you, deviated humans, think that Allah will not raise anyone from the dead. Among the causes of deviation from the straight and unwavering path of God is the malpractice of some humans to invoke the jinn and seek protection from them, which only increased their disobedience, leading to disbelief in such fundamentals of faith as the resurrection. It is narrated from the Prophet of Islam that whoever goes to a sorcerer, a soothsayer, or a liar and acknowledges their words certainly does not believe in all divine scriptures. These ayahs teach us the following points. 1. Those who drift away from religion, spirituality, and moral values only deceive themselves and are perpetual losers on the day of resurrection. 2. Those who indulge in such malpractices as invoking the jinn in pursuit of the perishable pleasures and properties of the world end up astray. And three, it is thus wrong to believe in the words of soothsayers and sorcerers who claim to have news of the future through jinn.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on December 27, 2023, a week before the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her. This day is celebrated as Women's Day in Iran. One of the issues is about working in society and managerial positions, which some women have asked me about. Gender does not matter in this case either. There are no limits to the presence of women in various managerial positions or in various positions in society and the government. Consider, for example, that the US had required one of our neighboring countries to fill 25% of their offices with female employees. They made it mandatory by force. That's wrong. Why 25%? Why not 35% or 20%? Determining a number or percentage here makes no sense. The criteria in this case should be the meritocracy. There may be a place where an educated, experienced, capable woman is better suited for a ministry than a man who is a candidate for the same position there, for example. In this case, the woman should become the minister. It is the same in the case of the representatives in the majlis.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Suppose that one or two representatives to the majlis are needed in a certain city, and one or two women and one or two men have signed up as candidates. Which one is more suitable? Their merits need to be assessed. Neither gender is preferred over the other. There are no limits or any restrictions in these areas either. This is what Islam tells us. People's merits need to be taken into consideration. Of course, a woman can be employed in these jobs, but these jobs should not deprive her from the important, essential job of looking after her household and having children. In some occupations, such as medicine, the presence of woman is wajibul kifaya, a religious obligation that addresses no specific person, and if it is performed by some duty-bound mukallaf, Muslims, the others will no longer be held accountable. It is wajib, religiously obligatory, to have female doctors, So it is important for women to pursue medical training until there is an adequate number of female physicians.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As the Zionist occupation continues its horrific massacres and, yes, ongoing genocide, more countries will feel inclined to move away from the Zionist regime, especially as legal proceedings advance. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, recently the long-awaited ruling of the International Court of Justice, ICJ, on the unfolding genocide in Gaza was delivered. It drew mixed responses, with some hailing it as a historic ruling and some others expressing their anger and disappointment. For anyone familiar with international law, especially under a U.S.-based global hegemonic order, tempering expectations is a must for such trials. We must take from this trial what we can and soberly analyze the shortcomings of the international system where necessary. The Hague-based court, led by a panel of 17 judges and representatives, began hearing by dismissing Israel's request to throw out the case entirely, which is an objective win for the Palestine case. For too long, the apartheid regime has enjoyed the cushion of the so-called American rules-based order, which only works for U.S. clients and against anyone else. It cannot be overstated that this specific detail, though small at face value, is itself a crushing defeat for the Zionist regime, which will now officially in international law and history have its name tethered toward genocide. The top UN court issued provisional measures for the Zionist regime to be taken immediately. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall, in accordance with its obligations under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in relation to the Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of the Article 2 of the Convention, in particular, A. killing members of the group. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to the members of the group. C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And D, imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall ensure with immediate effect that its military does not commit any acts described in point 1 above. By 16 votes to 1, Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. By 16 votes to 1, Israel shall take immediate and effective measures to ensure the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance to address the adverse conditions of life faced by Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of Article 2 and Article 3 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide against members of the Palestinian group in the Gaza Strip. By 15 votes to 2, Israel shall submit a report to the court on all measures taken to give effect to this order within 1 month, as from the date of the order. Much to the chagrin of many, both in Palestine and elsewhere, the provisional measures did not call for a ceasefire. The Zionist regime's aggression on the population of Gaza during the time of this issue has led to the murder of over 26,000 Palestinians, nearly half of them children, and thousands more trapped under the rubble still unaccounted for. The ICJ has acknowledged that genocidal crimes may be happening, but denying the Palestinians a ceasefire or not placing any independent mechanism to enforce the cessation of these hostilities has created a situation that tells on itself how limited its power is, at least for the Palestinian cause. The provisional measures also ask for the Tel Aviv occupation to report on itself and for it to hold itself accountable. Per the first ruling, Israel shall take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of the Convention. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, leading up to the court decision, commented on the aggression on Gaza, saying, "No one will stop us, not the Hague, not the axis of evil, and no one else. It is possible and necessary to continue until victory, and we will do it." Clearly, the child killer regime of Israel cannot be trusted to uphold the provisional measures from the very get-go. The Zionist regime has rejected and mocked the court and the UN as a whole, using its usual go-to smear of painting any of its opponents as anti-Semites. Despite these shortcomings, we must give credit where it is due. Not to the courts, but to the South African legal team who prepared an airtight case against the Zionist regime using the Zionist regime's own genocidal words and actions. With any crime of this caliber, the harder thing to do is to prove the intent of the crime. South Africa's legal team used Israeli officials' own statements and clips posted by Zionist troops in Gaza to force the court to proceed forward with the case, where the Tel Aviv regime's strategy was to throw the case out entirely. The case was built with precision. All but one judge supported the provisional measures, Julia Sebutain from Uganda. The government of Uganda immediately moved to distance itself from her. Indeed, the court decision has shown the world the limitations of the so-called rules-based order and of international appendages, but it also highlights the growing international isolation of the Zionist regime when held to account by an airtight case. The United States, Canada, the UK, and the EU have all stood in complete defense of the Zionist occupation throughout this entire legal dispute, with the United States calling South Africa's case meritless. The court moving forward with South Africa's use of the Genocide Convention pushes these countries, on the record, to one side of history while holding the Palestinian cause on another. Many countries have lined up behind South Africa and therefore Palestine, knowing full well that the time to take sides on the international stage is now. It is also worth noting that on the same day, this decision was delivered, the US, UK, Australia and Canada, all countries who have given unfettered support to the Zionist regime, cut off all funding from the UN appendage UNRWA, which provides vital support to Palestinians suffering in Gaza. The countries cite unverified Zionist claims that UNRWA employees were part of the October 7th military operation against Israeli occupation bases. However, given the timing of the UN decision and the Zionist smear campaign against the world body as a whole, it is clear this is politically motivated in order to punish the UN and send a message. As the Israeli occupation continues its horrific massacres and, yes, ongoing genocide against Gaza, more countries will feel inclined to move away from the Zionist regime, especially as legal proceedings advance. Think of it as holding your hand to a fire. Most sensible people know not to do this, but only the most arrogant people will insist on doing so, despite the severe burns it may cause. South Africa also intends to take the US and the UK to court for its complicity in the Gaza genocide. Clear lines are being drawn using the US own rules and order against it. For Palestinians and freedom fighters across the world, this legal scenario does indeed highlight the trajectory of growing extinction of so-called Western rules-based order, but all the while demonstrating the ineffectiveness of its own established organs. Where these organs are quick to act for US interest, they offer less than enthusiastic risk slaps when clear genocide is being conducted by a regime that does not care for rules. Indeed, there is no substitute for underground resistance. As the Zionist aggression continues, you can count on the axis of resistance to continue to deliver the necessary blows to the Israeli occupation in the court of Palestinian justice.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Nicaragua has dedicated an avenue in its capital to the people of Gaza and Palestine. The mayor's office of Managua held a ceremony to officially name the street and a nearby park, which has been named Parque Palestina, in recognition and solidarity with the ongoing 75-year struggle against the Zionist occupation. In attendance were Nicaraguan solidarity groups and representatives of the Palestinian embassy, who together with the mayor of Managua unveiled the new street name.
We are very happy doing this act in honor of the fighting people and their historical struggle and the unconditional bond with the people of Nicaragua. We are inaugurating an avenue with the name of Gaza, an avenue that is in our historic center of the city, and we are demonstrating that Palestine is there in our hearts, in the hearts of Nicaraguans.
Eso muy significativo.
It's very significant. This reflects the brotherhood and historical relationship between both peoples, both governments. In the midst of the Israeli bombing of our people in the Gaza Strip, Nicaragua has demonstrated many times its solidarity towards the Palestinian issue.
Earlier this month, the Government of Reconciliation and National Unity of Nicaragua filed a request before the International Court of Justice to join the case initiated by South Africa against Israel for the crime of genocide in Gaza, saying Nicaragua is determined to fulfill its obligation to contribute to preventing and punishing the genocidal acts that are being carried out in the Gaza Strip.
The children deserve to sleep in peace, women to live in peace, Palestinian families deserve to live in peace. That is why today we name this park with the great affection, with great solidarity with the people of Palestine.
This is not just any street. Peace to Gaza is located in one of the most transited arteries in the historic center of Managua. Homage paid by the Nicaraguan people and their government with the just cause of the Palestinian people. Camila Escalante, Managua.
Across the United States, local governments are passing resolutions demanding a ceasefire in Gaza as pro-Zionism sentiment continues its historic crumbling under the weight of daily Israeli war crimes. The third largest city in the United States, Chicago, also has the nation's largest Palestinian community, which was thrilled to see their city council pass a resolution demanding a permanent ceasefire.
We were on edge, honestly, for a while, and the fact that it was passed is just an amazing show of solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Palestine. We know that it doesn't necessarily change anything for them on the ground, but I think that this will definitely put pressure on our government to hear the will of its people in one of the largest cities of America, and hopefully this will influence some of their policy, and we will get a permanent ceasefire soon.
Ceasefire demands have been approved from major cities like San Francisco, Detroit, and Atlanta to suburbs and small towns, which are insisting on taking a moral stand. Words like apartheid and ethnic cleansing, which were once heavily censored in public life, are now being voted into the public record.
And you would wish that people in positions of power do the right things because they are the right things, because they're the moral thing to do. That doesn't always happen, but in Chicago it's a little bit different.
The United States was the only member on the United Nations Security Council to vote against a ceasefire, and they have paralyzed the Security Council on the issue of the genocide in Gaza. As congressmen in Washington reportedly refused to even engage with Palestinian activists, city councils have become the primary place with political power which will discuss the issue and reflect the historic shift in public sentiment towards Palestine.
It really shows that when you vote for progressive politicians, progress does happen. We not only saw a vote for a ceasefire, but we saw a vote for solidarity and community building as well. The ceasefire vote is not only for the Palestinian people, it's for all communities.
The local resolutions are mainly symbolic, but they aren't so local. They show support to Palestine and their allies around the world, and they prove to Washington that their unshakable support for Israel isn't shared across the country.